Hi, I'm Kelly Corrigan. You've probably never heard of me. Maybe you did. I wrote some New York Times bestsellers. I gave a TED Talk. But the reason I'm in your ear now is to invite you to listen to Kelly Corrigan Wonders. We talk to everyone from Bono to Amy Schumer, Spike Lee to Rainn Wilson, Krista Tippett and Bryan Stevenson about purpose, creativity, well-being, and what makes life worth living. Follow and listen to Kelly Corrigan Wonders on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are going to drastically turn the corner now with the show. April Bellagio, daughter of a serial killer named Edward Edwards. As an adult, she started to have these memories and started to connect them. And for some reason, got online and started looking for cold cases. When she was a child, she moved town to town, bad situation to bad situation, had brothers and sisters, a mother and father. She knew that her father had been to prison. She didn't realize that until she was 12 or 13 years old because he made money. He wrote a book called Metamorphosis of a Criminal that back in the 60s. He'd already been a con man, reform school guy. Mm-hmm. He'd already murdered. And he got out and the con continued. A true sociopath, psychopath, if you will, and a serial killer. But the way he would try to grift money is he would hook up with churches. And then he would go speak to them. He had it all practiced out. He had written this book. And again, I think we found one online for $1,000. Like it's that rare. Harper put it out in 72, I believe. And she remembered just moving city to city and weird circumstances and things happening and cruelty and control. And he wasn't one of those fathers. Like you'll hear people say, I never knew my father was a serial killer. She knew by the time she was 7 or 8, and then it really grew into anger and some real resentment by the time she was 12 or 13, the control and the abuse, the psychological games. Abuse, the pitting brother against sister, sister against sister, the beating her mother mercilessly in front of them, killing their pets for no reason. I mean, terrible stories. I'm reading this book last night, and there was a couple times I had to set it down and go get a bottle of water and come back and just kind of get my head back in the game because I just kept thinking, how can this all be happening to one little kid living in barns, living in campers, living on the outskirts of town, always trying to be, you know, she writes the book and talks about going from being a little kid, wanting her father's love and approval. And he was good at that, as con men are, right? Mm-hmm. What do they call that? Love bombing? Yeah. Where like you'll give someone so much love and then they crave it more than anything. But then the abuse starts and the mm-hmm. control starts. And what she saw her father do. And then so many blank parts and so many missing parts and pieces and questions she had. Fast forward all the way to being an adult. Her father had gone to jail one more time. She got a little freer, moved out as soon as she turned 18, never looked back. Still right. had contact. But he just kept doing the same thing. She got married. She had kids. The same kind of control, same yep. kind of things. And one day she decided to start looking at cold cases in towns that she'd lived in. Most she couldn't remember. But one really stuck with her, and she thought, I think my dad killed those people.
Right.
And she fought with it back and forth. She called her siblings, and they were like, what are you doing to dad? Like, that's crazy. But she couldn't shake it, and she finally reached out to this line, this, you know, call line, got a detective. He, you know, listened to her. She kind of unloaded everything, including her old childhood. He was like, okay, well, can we come get a DNA swab from you? Absolutely. It comes up a match. You know, she carries her father's DNA. Now, it's right. not identical DNA, but it definitely shows in sure. your DNA. And that led them to question him again. He had been questioned in these murders. Once it all started to unravel, he confessed to 8 murders, was it? And I think that they thought there were 7 more.
Yeah, well, he confessed immediately to 3, then it jumped to 5. They think he could have killed as high as 15.
It's an unbelievably dark story.
You earlier mentioned how they took the one kid in, got him to where he's going to go to the military.
Oh, it's so hard to explain all this. Like, yes, there were people outside the family that were in the periphery that ended up dead, and then they would move. Couples that would end up dead, and they would move. It was always like Sweetheart Lane murders. It would be couples murdered. Mm-hmm. And then they took in a kid. As all their kids were moving out, they were empty nesters, moved a basically adult 17-year-old kid in, got his name changed. Later on, he joined the military, and you see the setup at the very end. he finally confessed to killing him. He only ever adopted that kid and got him to take his names. The kid even changed his name, which would make him the beneficiary as the parents. He must have planned on killing him as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
But he decided once that didn't work out, he put them in the military and talked him into going to the military. Then he killed him. Where do you think that the death beneficiary went to? It went to these people. And finally, it all came unraveled. But the idea...
Hey, they just called. I got her on the line right now.
Oh, we're ready now. Okay. Guys, I will tell you, I spent 4 hours reading through this book of April Bellagio's. And there's no way to take you through the story in 10 minutes. But we're going to do the best we can. April Bellagio, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I have to tell you, I sat down with this book last night for about 4.5 hours and read through it. And I had to put it down a few times, man, because it absolutely broke my heart going through your childhood before we ever got to where we uncovered what your father was. Like...
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry that you, well, actually, no, I'm not sorry you felt that way. That was my goal. I wanted to take people on my emotional journey, and I was hoping that the readers would feel the same emotions that I went through.
But it's so complex. Like, this is unlike any story that I'm telling you that's ever been written in real life. It's not fiction. A story of a man who damaged from birth into reform school and abused himself, turns into a con man and a murderer. And these are stories, this before you were ever a glimmer in anyone's eye, this whole other life had happened. Prison, murder, con, the FBI, on the lam, women disappearing, the abuse of human beings. And he gets out, he writes a book, and it's called The Metamorphosis of a Criminal, but it's really just purpose served to be a bigger con, didn't it? He was just a con man through and through, a sociopath.
He was. And I couldn't even imagine writing a book like he did, admitting to the things that he did, the atrocious, the horrible things that he did. And it was his bragging right. You know, he felt like it was his bragging rights. And as an adult, I just look back and I don't get it. I can't wrap my head around it.
No, it was the true sociopath bragging of how he got away with it. But then he knew to turn it into a con, the metamorphosis of a criminal, because it would turn you into, you could grift churches and they would pay you to come and they would pay you to listen and you could become this other being in their eyes. But that just was the beginning of your life. Now he meets your mom and... That's where your part in the story comes in, but it's intertwined as you unfold and you unravel everything. How old were you when you finally read his book?
When I finally read his book, I was in seventh grade. I knew of his book before that because he would take us on speaking engagements, but I never read it until seventh grade. And even when I read it when I was in seventh grade, there was a lot I didn't understand, a lot I questioned, but there was also a lot I didn't understand.
But it started to make sense, though, right? Like the abuse of your brothers, your sisters, the control, the beatings of your mom, the way he would, what they call love bombing now. Like you adored him because he's your father, and he knew just how to give you enough praise to make you want more and then use that to control you. I mean, true sociopath.
You're correct. You know, I didn't recognize all of that at that age because that was all I knew. I started questioning things. And it really was when he went to prison for arson, right around that seventh grade, when I was in seventh grade, and him not being in the home and controlling us as much, that I started getting a glimpse of what the real world was like, what other families went through, or, you know, had a lot to do, was very involved in my church, and started seeing, you know, the way other families lived. And, you know, I started making choices then that I didn't want to live like my father and mother did. And so at a young age, I tried to make choices that I knew would better my life.
But, so you guys understand, you guys were moving into terrible, dilapidated, busted down squatter homes with the promise that your dad would fix them up. And, of course, you kids were doing all the work, but you were living in campers. You were living in a barn. This was, I mean, absolute... unacceptable situations. We're talking about places without heat, without running water.
Correct. Yes. And, you know, there again, that was just our life. And you know, for the longest time, I just accepted it. But you know what? I love camping now. So there's that.
Right. So, but I go through these stories of the arson of like, you come home and first, like, the barn was on fire or the building had burned and now your house is burned. And now you realize it was always a cover up because he was rigging the system. He was always trying to set up a system where he was innocent. He had an alibi, but he could profit from it.
Correct. Yeah. And when my mom was the one who told me about my dad burning down the barn, burning down the house. Obviously, the one house that he did go to jail for, my brothers told me about that one because he had my brothers help him participate. But it was finding out, you know, especially, you know, the animals that were destroyed from that fire and that farmhouse that I adored. That was, pretty devastating.
Sure. No, when I was reading the book, this is what I'm talking about. I had to set it down and just, I'm just talking about your cat and those dogs that you had and your Aunt Lucille and everything that when you put together a little kid's memory of what they were dealing with. This book, again, when I first saw it, you know, you put it in a category, Raised by a Serial Killer. I assumed it was this other book. Now, we fast forward through your life, and there's so much in this book, but I want to get to another part as well. You become an adult, 18, you can get out of the house. You don't break off all contact, but you certainly, you know to limit it. And you get married, you have children, but you can't escape this feeling. There's a feeling that there's something else there, that these people that you remember that died, you know, there's too many weird connections. Like when you were a kid, your father would get you up, you and your brothers, and said, we're going to go somewhere where you would normally have had a picnic and a barbecue and a fun day out in the field. But instead, he had you canvassing. And ultimately, that's where they found those dead kids, those dead bodies.
That's correct. It wasn't until I was an adult that I started putting together a lot of these memories or understanding them or connecting the dots. And as an adult, at the time that I turned my father in, I had three teenagers. And, you know, as a parent, when they leave the house and they go out to an activity, there's always that small fear of, you know, what could happen to them, them sure. not coming back. And that fear for me was very overwhelming at times because I had known of people, young people disappearing, teenagers disappearing. And ultimately, you know, doing the deep dive, trying to research the places that we lived, it was because of that, of being the parent and not even being able to understand or want to comprehend anything happening to one of my children.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking of the families of the victims. What were they going through? You know, how were they feeling? And that was the overwhelming desire or the overwhelming feelings that pushed me to continue to push me and to look into the crimes that I thought that my dad committed.
And one of the things I found with your father that I hadn't seen in other serial killer books was it was also premeditated, so he could either be a hero, he could have an alibi, he would always participate in the search, and so he looked like a super concerned, ultra good citizen, shielding him from being a suspect in these murders. That was what his MO was. Normally, when you see a serial killer, it's an unmistakable urge to kill, and it's a random, and then they move away from it. This was always someone your father knew. Someone could say they were connected to your family. And it just happened over and over again. But he always thought he was smarter than everybody else.
Yes. And you're right. And I think that he got off. I think that was the thrill for him, being right under the authorities' noses and getting away, or not just getting away with it, but leading them astray, leading them to think that other people did it.
Right, right. Then Danny Boy. This kid was already 17 years old. For some reason, he decided to petition the courts at he was 17, right? When he said, I want to become this name. I want to become a Danny Boy Edwards. It doesn't make any sense. Your dad clearly talked him into it, knowing if he was a sibling, or not a sibling, but a son, that if anything were to happen to him and it was insured, the money would go to his parents, right?
Correct.
And ultimately, that's what happened.
That was my dad, and that's what people who don't know my dad have a hard time understanding, how charismatic he was. People loved him. He was the life of the party. He entertained all the time. He did backyard barbecues. He was famous for his barbecue chicken. People loved to be around him. He was a lot of fun. The things that he did with me as a child, the scavenger hunts, the parties, the games, I implemented with my own children. They were a lot of fun, and right. he was a lot of fun.
All right. Listen, April, we have such limited time, but I got to tell you, man, there's a lot more to talk about. I hope we get a chance to catch up again later this week if you do more press. But, you know, we haven't really even got to the point where you had to make that decision with Detective Garcia to turn your father in and turn your world upside down, not just really find out, is my dad a serial killer, but have your whole family turn against you. And, I mean, and the fact that you thought, you know, and rightfully so, am I crazy? That's what I would think. I'd think, man, am I crazy right now? Am I inventing these memories? Like, how many hours you must have sat and just thought, am I insane? Is this really real? I mean, that must have been an incredibly terrible time.
And you are absolutely right. Reliving the memories and trying to sort through everything and writing this book, it was the hardest thing I have ever done in my life, because I didn't want to put anything in my book unless I could absolutely prove the memories were true. And that was involved me talking with people from my past, looking in archives, looking through pictures, listening to hours of tapes from my dad. It was excruciating, but it just was something that I felt that I had to do. It was just this overwhelming desire that I had to do it.
Well, listen, April, the book Raised by a Serial Killer, it's an incredible book. And hopefully we'll get a chance to have you back. And I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, babe.
I hope she comes back.
Jake was giving me the killer rap. But, I mean, we haven't even scratched the surface of this, of what was her childhood was like. But this guy, she grew up like he knew he was going to kill these people. He created a situation where he had the setups with everything.
Everything was how to do something for himself.
I have an alibi. I'm going to be the good guy, the hero. I'm going to lead the search charge for these children.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to adopt this kid. I'm going to bring him in. I'm going to get him into the military.
Mm-hmm.
It was always to get him on his name and then kill the kid, either through life insurance or through the military. And then the kid ended up not really going AWOL. He was never AWOL. He was mm-hmm. dead. And he confessed to it, you know.
The kid that was killed, I told him that his ride will be coming, and there were some cigarettes in the bottom of the duffel bag. I said, you go ahead and get them out. And Danny is squatted down, and he's trying to find the cigarettes. And I'm standing right here, and I have the sawed-off shotgun, and I ease it out of the bag while Danny's down there looking. And I put the shotgun kind of right here over his shoulder, right down here, easy, and I pulled the trigger. It was a single shot, so I put another shell in it and pulled it, the trigger, and he fell on over. So I then backtracked. I left him there, left the duffel bag there, changed clothes, and I went on home, and as if nothing had happened. I felt bad, but apparently not bad enough that I kept from doing it. I'm not new to crime. I've been in crime all my life. But no, I did not feel good about it, and I don't feel good about it now. Otherwise, why I would be asking for the death penalty? I deserve it, and I want the death penalty.
Yeah, yeah. But he didn't really want the death penalty because he thought he deserved it. He didn't want to spend his life in prison.
Yeah, he didn't want to live it out, yeah.
There's a whole nother story there where they were trying to get him to confess to this crime, which he did do. But he knew this other state, he believed at the time, had the death penalty. They actually had rescinded it. But that's how it played out. Mm-hmm. So he said, I'm not going to confess to this, but I will confess to this, because he wanted mm-hmm. the death penalty. So he didn't have to spend time in prison. And he'd already been to prison a bunch of times.
Mm-hmm.
But his setups, his taping of all the phone calls, making sure that he collected some things from the murder scene that he was going to plant on other people's property. He knew as a serial killer, and there were people he knew. Like, it was different than most you would ever see. And they say that most likely he went to his grave And he never confessed. There's probably, as many as 8 or 9 more people?
Yeah, they say the number I saw was 15 at least, but maybe 15 plus.
Yeah, and the problem is they didn't have DNA testing way back then. But so much of the evidence was all compromised.
His evil mind was so advanced of how he was going about it.
Oh, yeah.
The DNA that they took from her, I think that's the one they linked him to the sweetheart murders.
Right.
Where 1980, it was a guy and a girl leaving a wedding.
Yeah, just a little young little kid, like 17, 18 years old.
He killed him, raped her. Yeah.
Yeah. And they finally connected that DNA that they found on her dress. But back then, the first part of it, they knew to collect it, but they hadn't found a way to really categorize it, like spot on. So by the time that she grew up and became an adult, had children, and gave up her own DNA, that's what linked him. And then slowly, surely, after all the questioning, the cops knew. Like, he was infuriating. There's a whole part in the book where they bring him in, and they're giving him the 8-hour interrogation. Mm-hmm. But he is so prepared for this, even at 70 years old or something, 68 years old, that he knew how to confound them. Like, to the point where on the tape she was listening to, she talks about hearing the detectives get furious. Because he's that good at lying. He's that good at not giving the answer mm-hmm. that they're looking for. He is such a sociopath. He is just a half step ahead. And he finally, to get his way, understands he has a little currency. And it's information about who he's killed, where they are, and what happened. So he uses it to get what he wants. Even in the end, that's how it played out for that guy.
Yeah, also, good on her. I mean, good on her to write the book to kind of see where it all comes from. But she was a sharp kid, too. Like, I read some stuff on her yesterday. By the time she was 11, for sure, she knew, she had a strong suspicion stuff was going on. And she picked up on little things like her, Edward Edwards was obsessed with newspaper clippings of local murders. And, she started to piece together, everywhere we go, Dad's interested in who was murdered, you know, close by. And then she knew, like, unless you're in the military, it's weird that we live in Ohio. We go to Wisconsin. We're in Kentucky. We're back somewhere else in Ohio. Like, they just kept jumping around. Oh. And she's like, this is weird. Like, people don't live like this.
I will tell you, it's a dark book. Like, it's dark.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, it's serial killer, clearly. But it's another level down than that, man.